person that is going to determine what the future will bring, and I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but we ask you to hold your calls for the time being, unless we actually ask for calls, because we have on the line, certainly one of my favorite guests, Ellen Gundersen-Traylor, and she has written, I don't know, how many books have you written, Ellen?
It's 17 now, Dr. Stan.
And, of course, it's on Ruth, and it's on Mary Magdalene. And, of course, she has some stories about Israel. All of her books, of course, are biblically centered. And we carry, I think, just about every book she's written on Melchizedek, and certainly so many of the major people in the Bible that you may not even realize their significance. There's a wonderful book on Noah, what things were like at the time of the Great Flood. Anyway, thought maybe this evening we could talk about a series of... Ellen has written a couple of books. They're really modern books. They're really based upon the prophetic nature of Israel and the things that are destined to happen there. And I remember, of course, I remember one of them was called The Priest. What was the other one?
The Oracle.
The Oracle. Well, these are the stories of sort of an Indiana Jones-like character. Why don't you sort of give the background of those stories?
Well, thank you for having me on. The Priest and the Oracle are the two books I've done on current events. All of my others have been historical novels, but these are modern-day stories. In fact, on Barnes & Noble and Amazon, they're billed as international thrillers. And they do follow a character by the name of David Rothmeyer, who is based on a couple of archaeologists that I have met and interviewed over the years over in Israel. He's kind of a composite of them. And it has to do with the rebuilding of the temple in Israel, and which, of course, has not happened yet. But there are a number of movements in Israel, in Jerusalem, related to the attempt on the part of the Jews, their plans to rebuild their temple, which of course was taken down, destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. As you know, at that point, the Jews were dispersed throughout the world. That's called the diaspora, the dispersion of the Jews, and they lost their homeland. And it, all through those centuries, even up till this very day, the Jews pray for the rebuilding of their temple so that Messiah can come. Of course, the Orthodox Jews do not believe that Jesus was the Messiah, so they're still looking for him. And but in order for him to rule from Jerusalem, he will need a place to do that from. So that's what these stories are about, and they have a lot to do with current events right now.
And really, they're fascinating. It's wonderful, wonderful stories. But, of course, it's biblical-based. And the thing about Ellen is she goes to these areas. She does a tremendous amount of research, historical and personal research. You know, and so her stories really come alive. And whether it be the story of Mary Magdalene or the story of Noah. But as far as I'm concerned, I love these stories. In fact, Ellen is in the process of coming up with a third in the series, The Priest, The Oracle, and we'll tell you a little bit more about that when we get back here. But this has so much to do with what's really going on today, because a lot of things going on in the Middle East don't make any sense unless you understand their prophetic nature. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest, Ellen Gundersen-Traylor. Why don't you sort of pick the thought up? I mean, sometimes when you read the news, you have the feeling that if you didn't have any idea what the prophecies were all about, that so much of what's happened and the historical events that led up to the establishment, reestablishment of the nation of Israel, none of these things would have happened.
That's right. And one of the things that I point out in the introduction to my books is that I hope that the readers are paying attention to the news every day, because if they are, that they will see that the scenarios in these books are confirmed on a daily basis in the news. These books were written a few years ago. The Priest came out in 98 and the Oracle in 2001, just a few months before the attack on the World Trade Center. But, you know, when that attack happened, Dr. Stan, I was absolutely deluged with emails from my readers asking me, how did I know that this would happen? Well, I did not write about an attack like that, but I did write about the inevitability of moves against the Western world on the part of Islam, and I did tie in what had already happened at the World Trade Center in 1990 and also in 93. You may recall in 1990, Meir Kahane, who was the leader of the Zionist Jews in New York City, was assassinated, and he was killed by the same people who attempted to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993. And then ultimately, of course, those people were connected with those who did finally destroy the World Trade Center.
And, of course, they're also tied into Oklahoma City, too, weren't they?
Yes. Well, yes. And so because I had hinted at these things in the books, people were, you know, wanting to know, how did I know these things? And like I say, I didn't foretell that particular kind of a devastation, but, you know, the attempt had been made before in 1993. And so I did have that in the story, and I talked about, you know, what was behind that. And, you know, to this day, Dr. Stan, it has not really come forth very clearly in the media just why the World Trade Center would have been the target. You know, there have been various theories. Well, they were the tallest buildings in the world.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment.
Okay.
With Ellen. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ellen has been simply telling us that after, you know, the attack on the World Trade Center came, so many of the people who had read her books emailed her and wanted to know how she knew it was going to happen, because she talked about the attack on Meir Kahane back in 1990. He was led the Zionist Jews in New York, and he was killed by the same people who tried to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993. And then, of course, if you read her books, you find there's a tie-in to certainly she had an opportunity of talking to the lawyer who defended Timothy McVeigh that dealt with the Oklahoma City bombing in 1996, and she began to realize, of course, this relationship between the radical movements in this country and the Islamic terrorists in this country. So, so she was expecting there would be these attacks on the United States, and they're prophesied in her books. And of course, the second book came out, The Oracle, came out in 2001, before the World Trade Center bombing, and I've been waiting ever since 2001 for the next book, and apparently it's in the it's on the way very shortly.
It's in the works. I am well into it, and as I have explained before on your program, when that attack happened, I needed time to kind of reconnoiter and digest all of that and then take a while to see where things were going before I moved directly into the next book. But I already had the framework of the story in mind. But anyway, as I was saying, there have been various theories as to why the World Trade Center would have been attacked. But I have my own theory, and I did bring it out in these books, and I bounced it off Stephen Jones, who was Timothy McVeigh's attorney, and you know, he seemed to be quite collaborative with me on that. Would you like to hear my theory?
Yes, you go right ahead.
Okay. Well, my theory is that it was not because they were the tallest buildings in the world, or that because it was New York City in particular, which is so important to our country, But actually, and it wasn't an attack so much on the Western world, which is what we've been hearing, isn't it? That it was an attack against the Western culture. My belief is that even more important than those theories, and those have their place, but is that it was the headquarters of world Zionism, the headquarters of all the wealth of the Zionist Jews in the world, was headquartered in the World Trade Center. What this was, Dr. Stan, in my opinion, was an attack on Israel. The Jewish people, and particularly the Temple Movement. Israel and the Temple Movement had its sponsors in the World Trade Center. And one good reason to take it down would be to short-circuit that flow of funds going to Israel, and some of which was going into the Temple Movement.
All right, fine. And so this takes us back to what is happening in Israel. And this is the most amazing story. I mean, the Temple was destroyed in 70 A.D. The Jewish people were dispersed throughout the world. And now, at this time in history, they've suddenly gone back to Israel. And, of course, they established the State of Israel in 1948. Now, what other country has ever been dormant for almost 2,000 years and suddenly reconstituted? And then war after war after war, and each war the Israelis should have lost.
Yeah.
I mean, by all right, there's no earthly way that they could have prevailed.
No.
But I don't believe that there was an earthly way, do you?
No, it was not an earthly thing. It is it's a divine intervention. And that is not to say that all Jews are righteous or that Israel is always right in everything it does. What it does say is that God had a foreordained plan for Israel. It was prophesied time and time again in the Old Testament and in the New Testament that Israel, God had not forgotten his people, his chosen people, and that he would bring them back into the land again. And this, of course, is what happened in 1948. It was an outgrowth of the Holocaust in Europe, where Hitler thought he had squashed the Jews forever, but instead they rose from the ashes. And not only individuals survived, but they founded a land and a country again, which, as you say, had been dormant for 2,000 years. What other society has managed to keep its language and its traditions and its culture intact when they were dispersed all over the entire world for 2,000 years? It is an unheard of story, except for the story of Israel.
And, of course, the things that you bring out in your book, the fact that the Jewish leaders, the Jewish priests, have always felt that they wanted to have somebody of the direct lineage of the original Jewish priests. And they want to tell a little bit about that, because they actually, the only way that they could tell who the right people were was with DNA that was available now that had never been available until this time in history.
Right.
And that's such a fascinating story. Would you like to develop those ideas?
Yes. Just a few years ago, a man was sitting in a synagogue, a Jewish man was sitting in a synagogue, and he was observing the Kohen males, who the Kohens are the keepers of the priesthood of Israel, and the Levites, of course, are also the keepers of the priesthood. The Kohens are the ones from whom the high priest of Israel would come, and the name Kohen, Dr. Stan, is like the name Smith in English. It is so common. They say there are as many Cohens in New York City as there are bagels in the bakeries. And so who's to say that, you know, which one of these would be the heir to the high priesthood of Israel? Well, this particular man happened to be a genetic scientist. And he came up with an idea. He knew that if you took the saliva of an individual, you could test it for various chromosomal points and so forth, and the DNA, And so he actually began a scientific study. He and a cohort of his began a scientific study. They went all over the world, and they collected saliva samples from people who claimed to be of the Cohen lineage. Now, incredibly, there were black people in Africa. There were people in Ireland. There were people in Taiwan. I mean, we're talking, this cuts across racial and cultural barriers entirely. But these people had some strain of family history that told them that they were of this background. Well, so he decided to follow this thing through, and he collected all these samples and studied them and found that in the vast number of cases, these people had a specific genetic marker in their chromosomes, which was unique to the Cohen lineage. He took there was no doubt of their Cohen lineage. It went back and back throughout their family history. No doubt they were of the Cohen lineage. He discovered they all had this marker, and then he studied these others who you would think would not even be Jews, let alone Cohens, and found that indeed many of them also had this same marker. And so what he found here was that the Cohen lineage has been kept remarkably untainted down through 4,000 years, 3,500 years of history from the time of Moses on. So we're going back three and a half centuries, okay? And so then it's just a step from there, Dr. Stan, taking genealogies, taking studies of names and tracing them back through etymology, taking all kinds of scientific studies and bringing them together. At some point, you could actually narrow the field down and ultimately designate that one person who would be the ultimate high priest of Israel. Now, why is this important? Because without the high priest of Israel, you cannot, even if you have a temple, you won't be able to conduct anything in it. So here, all of a sudden, in the 21st century, the end of the 20th century, we have all these things coming together. We have the nation of Israel founded. We have these DNA capabilities, which we've never had before. We have movements in Israel rebuilding, getting ready to rebuild the temple, which has been prophesied. We have the implements, the harps, the vestments, all these things being designed and planned and built right now for that ultimate temple. And why is that important to us as Christians? Because we know that Jesus Christ, when he returns, as the Messiah, will reign from that temple.
But before that, of course, somebody else will reign there, won't they?
They will.
And this is the thing. You see, the Jews are waiting for the return of their Messiah. They're going to be misled that their Messiah is. But he's not. He's going to be the Antichrist.
That's right.
And in a similar manner, the Muslims wait for the return of the Mahdi, and they believe that he is going to be the great ruler. The Hindu waits for the return of Maitreya. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Christian waits for the return of Jesus Christ, the one true God. And really, what an exciting time, because we see all of these various things fitting together. There are people in Iran today who want to bring on a world chaos so the Mahdi can return,
right,
and bring us all under their control. Well, why don't you just pick up this story there? Certainly, the group, they call them the Temple Mount Group, and you sort of weave their story into your books, don't you?
Well, my agency in my book is called the Temple Consortium, and it is based on a group, an actual group in Jerusalem today called the Temple Institute. There is another group called the Temple Mount Faithful, and yet others. But the most scholarly, really, of them all, and the ones which have put the most financial backing into all of this, is the Temple Institute. And the rabbis in my books are based on people that I actually met there at the Temple Institute. All of my characters in my books have their roots in adventures that I myself had going across the world studying for this and meeting people and interviewing them. I had many great adventures, and actually I was even followed quite a bit of the time, particularly when we were in Germany and England, and you know, I had so many contacts with various rather controversial characters that I'm sure the powers that be, you know, that watch these things were well aware of my activities, and my husband and I were definitely under surveillance as we traveled through Europe and England.
Well, do you think you were under the surveillance by the Mossad or what?
No, you know, it mainly took place in England. I think it did happen in Germany, but I think it was all connected. And we have talked to a number of people since that happened, and they've given us their ideas of who it really was. But we had hooked up with the head of B'nai B'rith in London, and from that point on, we were definitely being tracked. And I think what happened was that B'nai B'rith, along with the British intelligence, was watching us very carefully. We were asking a lot of very, very sensitive questions. I had been emailing for months across the world, and making phone calls, having phone conversations with, you know, a lot of sensitive characters, both in the United States and elsewhere. And I think, knowing what I do about Interpol, you can only do so much of that before it's picked up on.
Well, of course, the thing is that British intelligence, as American intelligence, has a strong tie into the occult, who would be very, very interested and very concerned about too much coming out of the truth about what's really going on behind the scenes.
Well, I could tell you some very spine-tingling stories about our adventures, but just to give you an example, in London, every day when we would come back to our hotel, the locks had been changed on the door, and we had to go down to the main desk and get somebody to come up and reprogram the entrance to our door. You know, it had the...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here.
Okay.
Well, Ellen has been saying that when she and her husband were traveling in Europe, and they were, of course, been doing a lot of research for her books, and actually, of course, she and her husband were followed in England and presumably in Germany as well. And certainly she thinks it's tied into British intelligence, and I would certainly concur, knowing what I do, that there are elements within British intelligence going all the way back to into the 1500s in the time of Bloody Mary, Queen Mary, and Francis Bacon. Elements of the British intelligence were involved in the occult. They still are, as with certain elements within our own intelligence agencies, the Central Intelligence Agency. There really are these occult forces out there who are very aware of the spiritual implications of everything going on in the world today, because behind everything happening politically and militarily and educationally and culturally are these occult forces. Would you agree with that?
Oh, well, everything goes back to good and evil, doesn't it?
It sure does.
But, you know, even if it weren't an actual occult thing, it was definitely a politically sensitive situation that we were involved in. And I'm not saying that it wasn't connected to the occult as far as those who were concerned about what we were doing. But I am saying, even if it wasn't involved with that, the things that we were dealing with were getting at issues that were so sensitive. When I spoke with Stephen Jones for 3 hours face-to-face one day...
Now, for our listeners, Stephen Jones was Timothy McVeigh's attorney. Go ahead.
Yes. He told me that he could not tell me anything, but he said, you tell me what you think, and I will tell you yes or no. And so for 3 hours, I gave him my theories, which were going to be woven into my books, and he would sit there and say, yes, 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 yes. You have it. Yes, you have it. So we know that his life, the life of his family, was threatened repeatedly. He was in a very sensitive situation there.
And, of course, what he had really uncovered was the relationship between the radical militia groups in America and the Islamic terrorists. Would that be a fair statement?
That and the FBI.
Right.
Remember when 5,000 pages of material were just accidentally misplaced in the courtroom?
Right, and of course.
And that was material that the FBI did not want to come to light.
Well, they don't dare let the American people know the truth about what really happened with Oklahoma City bombing, what happened at Waco, what happened with the downing of TW-800,
right.
And certainly never to know what really happened on the morning of September 11th.
Right, right. Well, anyways, I'm kind of getting off the track of our original subject, I guess, but I don't think I had ever told you this, had I?
No, you haven't.
That my husband and I were tracked that way. And spine tingling, we at the time, to be quite frank, we didn't really know what was going on. I mean, it's like it took a while to sink in, but I can remember one evening when we got back to our hotel and we couldn't get in again because supposedly something had happened to the locks. It was one of these digital lock things, you know, that you had to use a card on. When we got in there, I just had this feeling that things were not the way we had left them. And I could not lay my finger on it, but I just knew that our bags, the things that we had left lying around, were not quite the way we had left them. And my husband and I decided then and there that we would not discuss anything to do with my research in the room. But the next day, when we went out, everywhere we went, from the moment we stepped out of the hotel until sunset when we headed back to the hotel, the same pair of very peculiar-looking people showed up at every single place we went to. And these were very unusual-looking man and woman. They stood out like sore thumbs, and we've been told since then that that was on purpose.
That's to intimidate you.
Yes, so that we would realize we were being followed. Mm. And we tested it at one point. We were standing outside the Tower of London, and I turned, they were sitting over on a bench, and I said, Dick, I'm going to pretend I'm taking a picture of the London Bridge, and I'm going to turn and take one of them. And as I turned, they were gone. And then we said, okay, we're going to walk over and try to find Shakespeare's Globe Theater. It was about four bridges down. It took about an hour to get there, and when we got there, they were sitting on a bench right outside the Globe Theater.
We'll be back in just a moment with Ellen Gunness and Trevor. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this may sound rather dramatic, but this sort of thing does happen. Of course, what Ellen was doing, they were beginning to try to understand all the things that were going to have to be necessary before the sacrifices could be again on Temple Mount. Now, they actually have the temple, these sacrifices there. They're going to have to build a tabernacle, and some people think they're going to have to destroy the Dome of the Rock, this beautiful Muslim church that was written there, a mosque that was built there, you know, in the late 600s. But under any circumstances, before they can begin doing that, they have to have the ashes of the red heifer. And you actually analyzed each one of the things that would be necessary. And there are not that many things once they know who the priest is. Mm-hmm. They probably know exactly where the Ark of the Covenant is. Mm-hmm. But what about the ashes of the red heifer? Why is that important?
Well, that's my second book, The Oracle. In the first book, they're looking for the legitimate heir to the high priesthood, and David Rossmeyer, being a linguistic archaeologist, is enlisted to track down the genealogy and the DNA and so forth to locate the high priest. In The Oracle, he is looking for the implements necessary for the high priest to do his duties, which would be the ashes of the red heifer and the Urim and Thummim, which would be a device called the which I call the oracle. It's a device which can supposedly interpret the will of God. So again, he takes off on a globe hopping journey, and these books weave several stories together in one, don't they, Dr. Stan?
Yes, they do, and you do that so well, you know, all these various stories, and then the end of the book, they all come together.
Yeah.
I love that.
Well, it's called a convergent novel, for those of you who like to study literature, but it takes all these different strands of story. And in the case of The Oracle, we're weaving together a number of interesting scenarios, and the same in the priest. In both of them, we have an old Irish Catholic priest who teaches at Oxford and who has kept a secret for 40 years. Only he knows where this thing is, and it is the final key to the genealogy of the high priest, and I won't tell you what that is right now. And in the second one, we have some characters in Montana who get involved with people in...
We'll left off right
okay.
There. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ellison is simply going into the background of how these stories weave together, the convergence novels. In other words, there are three or four different storylines, and they all come together in the end. But, of course, the story deals, the first book, which is The Priest, deals with David Rothmeyer trying to track down the priest, the man who will be the high priest. And actually, this sort of thing has really gone on. It wasn't David Rothmeyer, because he's a fictional character, but there really has this been a desire to find the man who will be the high priest when they begin the sacrifices there in the temple. And then of course, with the second a book, it's called The Oracle, and it's the effort to find the ashes of the red heifer. You have to have an unblemished red heifer, and if you can find one today, fine, or you have to have the ashes of the last red heifer that was sacrificed, and we're going back almost 2,000 years. And then, of course, The Oracle, which is something that allows people to know the will of God. So pick up the story there.
Okay. Well, as I was saying, in these books you have these diverse characters who don't seem to be connected until you really get into it, and then you find that they're all woven together. But we hop from Montana to Columbus, Ohio. We have a bunch of bikers chasing after a Jewish girl who has one of the keys to all this. You know, it sounds, when I talk about it, like so much hodgepodge and really just ridiculously complex, but you know, really, that's the way it is when you set out to piece the truth together. It takes you into all kinds of places, and you meet all kinds of people that you never dreamed you would ever need to talk to.
And, of course, really, they're fascinating adventure novels. They're the sort of novels you just don't want to put down. And, you know, people talk about the Da Vinci Code. These are every bit as exciting as Dan Brown's book, only these are based upon biblical truth, not the effort to destroy Christianity, which was Dan Brown's mm-hmm. goal. In fact, I think these would make wonderful, wonderful movies.
Well, I should tell you right now, I will ask for your prayers. One of my books is in the hands of a producer who made the two biggest selling movies of all time. He made Return of the Jedi and Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark. And he has Noah right now.
Really?
Yeah.
I would think he'd be more interested in the priest.
Well, maybe we'll have to give that to him next. But anyway, he has Noah. But that's aside from what we're talking about. Yeah, I'd love to see these made into films. I think they... Well, you know, did you see National Treasure?
Yes,
Yeah, it's this, you know, that has some of the same flavor to it, but it's not based on truth at all, whereas these are. So, do you want to hear about the third one?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, well, the third one is called The Cornerstone. And in this one, David Rothmeyer is enlisted to figure out where the temple actually stood on Mount Moriah.
And, of course, if you've ever been to Mount Moriah, this probably would have a lot more meaning to you because, of course, the golden doors there, and it's prophesied that they would never be opened until Christ would come through them. And they've been sealed shut for, what, all these thousands of years?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Arabs sealed them shut, the Muslims, under Suleiman, believing that they could keep the Messiah out just by filling them in. And then they put a graveyard in front of them, believing that the Messiah would never walk through a graveyard. But what they failed to account for was the resurrection. But anyway, yes, they thought they could keep Messiah out, but they will not keep him out. He'll come through the eastern gate, and he'll take his place in the temple.
Right, because in the meantime, why, they're going to have to get the temple built, and the question then is, where on the Mount Moriah will the temple go?
Well, and the reason that is so important and so sensitive is because the Dome of the Rock is up there. Al-Aqsa Mosque is there. And that is Arab territory. That's an Arab sanctuary. Of course, they believe that Muhammad took his night ride to heaven on that, from that rock that's under the dome. But we know that that rock was part of the, well, it was the original threshing floor that King David bought, to build the temple on. And so the courtyard actually contained that rock, and very likely the sacrifices were made there.
And, of course, that was supposedly where Abraham was going to sacrifice Isaac.
Right, exactly. That was the original spot, and also Jacob had his dream there. That was the rock that he made his pillow and slept on, and a pillow in the... In the Near East is a big couch. It's not just something under your head. But he slept on that rock and had his dream of the ladder stretching to heaven. Moriah, by the way, means wisdom teacher, teacher of wisdom. So if we can get a grasp on how important that location is in the mind of God and what it really means in his economy and in his purposes in the world, then we begin to become wise. Our eyes are opened to the purposes of God in the world when we start to understand his purposes with Israel. And his purposes with Israel center on that holy place. When Jacob awoke from his dream there, he said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. Surely this is the gate of heaven." So he had actually seen the gate of heaven and the angels coming and going between earth and heaven right there. So that it's a very deep and very profound thing we're talking about here, and that's why Satan is so anxious to keep it under his own control.
And because the thing, the implications of what we're really talking about, we're talking about people, Jewish rabbis, who are actually planning on rebuilding the ancient temple that was destroyed in 70 A.D. And they're getting, they have all the implements together. Have they got the ashes, the red heifer yet?
No, they don't have that yet.
But they're looking. They're looking all over the world for an unblemished red heifer without one gray hair or anything on it.
And also they're looking for the original ashes. They need one or the other, like you said. If they can't find the original ashes, and we really haven't explained what these ashes were used for.
Why don't you explain to our listeners?
Moses, in Leviticus, talks about how the priest would purify himself so that he could go in and offer atonement for the people. And the way he was purified and the way the implements of the sacrifices were purified was by having water mixed with the ashes of this red cow sprinkled on them. That was the purification. I don't know what you'd say there. There probably wasn't a chemistry that happened, but, you know, it was an act of obedience on the part of the people to follow what God told them to do. And this is what God said would be the ritual purification of the priest. So now that the original red heifer's ashes were kept in an urn, and as they would begin to dissipate and they'd get down where there wasn't much left, they would kill another cow. Didn't have to be a pure red one, but just another cow, and sprinkle it with the ashes. So then its ashes were considered pure, okay? So you had the original ashes being used to sprinkle the next cow, and then its ashes and so on being used. In the time of Jeremiah, when the Babylonians were getting ready to invade, Jeremiah is the last one who mentions, or who seems to have had, the ashes of the red heifer. And we don't know what he did with them. If that could be discovered, and that's what my book, The Oracle, is partly about, is what did Jeremiah do with the ashes? Where did he take them? Where did they end up? There are a lot of theories about that. If they could be found, that would solve the problem. In the meanwhile, if in case they're never found, the other alternative is to find another pure red heifer with only no more than 3 white hairs on it. And they have thought they found it a few times. There was one in Texas, there was one in Sweden, but it always ended up that they were not.
And then, of course, the other thing is the Ark of the Covenant. Don't they have to have the Ark of the Covenant?
That seems to be somewhat debatable as to whether they'll actually have to have the Ark of the Covenant or not. I think they would. I don't know why they wouldn't, because in the Holy of Holies, the Ark of the Covenant, part of it was the mercy seat, where the Shekinah glory of God would come and settle on that. So I believe that they would have to have the Ark of the Covenant. And there are different theories as to where it might be. I did not go into that in either of my books because it's been done to death. You know, there have been so many stories written about it in movies, and you know, I didn't go into the Ark of the Covenant. But there are some various stories about where it might be.
So, of course, some people think it's in Ethiopia, and the Ethiopians think it's in Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there are other people who think it's hidden in a cave not too far from Jeremiah's grotto.
And possibly underneath the Well of Souls, or the Well of the Spirits. No, excuse me, the Dome of the Spirits on Mount Moriah.
Okay, and so that these are things that, of course, the Jews spend full time studying
right.
in preparation. I mean, they're the people who've been working at this literally for dozens of years.
Mm-hmm.
And they are all prepared. They feel the time is very close, don't they?
Oh, yes, absolutely. But see, if you go to Israel today and you talk to these people and you talk to anybody over there in the know on this, they will say that the moment we set foot on Temple Mount to do this, World War III will break out.
Well, of course, the thing is, what I think most people do not understand, there are people within the Iranian government. One of them, I believe, is the current president, Ahmadinejad.
Right.
And I think he wants to bring about World War III. This is why he's doing everything that is totally irrational. I mean, saying that the Holocaust didn't take place, we've got to wipe Israel off the face of the world, we've got to move Israel to Europe, we're going to go ahead and develop our nuclear material, and we're not going to work with the Russians, we're going to do it our way. And it's almost as if he is intentionally doing everything he can to inflame the Israelis and the Americans to precipitate an attack on his country, which could very well precipitate World War III.
Well, he knows that the Israeli weapons are poised right at him. And that they would not hesitate to do a peremptory strike. According to things that I have read and which you have in fact shown me and sent to me, they believe that this 12th Imam will not reveal himself until there is a cosmic chaos and war and huge confrontation between good and evil, and then he will usher in an era of universal peace. But in order for him to come, there has to be war first.
And of course, the 12th Imam is really the Mahdi, the returning of the prophet.
Right, uh-huh. And he's been in hiding since the 9th century, supposedly. They're just waiting for him to come back, but they're trying to help him out by creating this, by baiting the rest of the world.
Isn't that really the most incredible story?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that just before you called, and to me it's the fulfillment of Genesis 16:12, which says, Ishmael shall be a wild man, his hand against every man, and every man's hand against him. Never before in history has there been this possibility, this potential, that one race of people, being the Arab people descended from Ishmael, would actually have the capacity to have their hand against everybody else on earth. And doesn't that sound like what they've been doing for the past few years? You know, New York City wasn't the only place that was hit. There was Barcelona, there was they've been acting up in London, in Russia, the Philippines, the Sudan, Pakistan. I mean, this is all over the world.
Sure, Jordan.
They're attempting to stir up trouble everywhere against people who've never even been their enemies. Well, and this is the only time in history when that prophecy has the potential of being fulfilled.
Well, I think that we are living, Helen, in some of the most exciting times in history. And really what a privilege it is, at least to have a glimpse of what's going on. We don't have all the answers, but all the answers really are there in the scriptures. It's just a matter of piecing them together, and you've done such a wonderful job in your books. I should tell our listeners, we do carry both The Priest and The Oracle, and if you haven't read Ellen's books, you really missed a treat. Certainly my wife has read all of them, my secretary has read all of them. I've read most of them, because I have to read them before I do the interviews, and I always enjoy them, and they're most wonderful. Biblical ones based on the Bible are just taking the scriptures and studying the scriptures, and then, of course, taking a little bit of literary license to make the story come together. But they're really fascinating books. If you'd like to know more about them, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We're talking about the Priest and the Oracle, those are two more modern books, but the rest of them are really all based upon biblical characters, and they all come alive. Ellen has a wonderful gift. Certain people have a gift of writing novels, and these are wonderful, wonderful novels. I know my wife is one of your greatest admirers.
Well, thank you. I'd like to just, if I have a moment, I don't know how we're doing time-wise, mention one incident that happened about a month ago that was really, like, taken from one of the books.
Go ahead.
Do you remember in Toledo, Ohio, when they unearthed a cell of Al-Qaeda members?
Right.
Okay. The Priest, we have a cell of I didn't call them Al-Qaeda, but I called them jihadists, located in western Montana. And, you know, I have said all along that the Elohim City Bunch, where Timothy McVeigh was groomed, was all tied in with Al-Qaeda in the Philippines.
Hold, we'll be back in just a moment here. Why don't you pick up the story there, Ellen?
Well, we know that the people of Elohim City, where Timothy McVeigh and his cohort, what was it, Terry Nichols, were groomed.
This was a Christian Identity Center there, and a center run by Reverend Millard there, and what was that, in Oklahoma, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, right. In Oklahoma, right. And anyway, they were trained by a guerrilla warfare teacher, a German, and I patterned one of my characters in The Priest after him.
Andy Strassmeyer.
Yes. You remembered. Okay. anyway, he was originally training Al-Qaeda in the Philippines. Dr. Stan.
I didn't know that, but
yes.
That would be a tall surprise. He was obviously in German intelligence, so...
Yes. Yeah, and I didn't tell you about being followed in Germany, but that's a whole other story. But so anyway, yes, this cell in Toledo is just one of many, 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 many which will be found. And they are... They will find that they are tied in with... Aryan Nations groups around the country.
Now what you're suggesting then is that the Islamic terrorists are working with the Aryan Nation groups. In other words, you have these two groups, one the radical so-called right and the other, I don't know if you want to call them radical left, call them what you will, all of these revolutionary groups based upon hatred of America interlocked, and we see this in South America where Hugo Chavez, who's a dedicated Marxist, is working with the Iranian militants.
And some of Sinn Féin and the Irish revolutionaries,
right,
are somewhat tied in. Terror is terror, and these people help each other.
They sure do.
One of the things that the Irish revolutionaries have in common with the Arab people and with the Aryan Nations people is the hatred of Israel, hatred of the Jews, and this goes clear back into the Middle Ages. This is one thing that I really try to bring out in my books, is that radical Islam and radical freedom movement here in this country are in cahoots, at least on one thing, not only hatred of the American government, but hatred of Israel. And they support one another in endeavors that attempt to bring Israel down.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening has been Ellen Gundersen-Traylor, and she's just pointing out that the radical militant, the militia groups here, and anti-Semitic groups are certainly working in league with the Islamic terrorists because of a common hatred of Israel, and they all want to destroy Israel. Would that be a fair statement?
Oh, definitely, yes. Absolute anti-Semitism.
And it's growing all across America. That's unfortunately, but it's a reality that we have to face.
Well, we have to figure that Hitler You know, he's the forefather, at least in the Western world, of the Nazi movement. And then you have people like this Muhammad, I don't have it in front of me, Ahmadinejad.
Ahmadinejad, right.
Yeah, the president of Iran, you know, who, I mean, he almost looks like Hitler, you know. He swaggers like him, he talks like him, he gestures like him. And, you know, this is nothing new. In the story of Esther, Haman was just like that.
Hey, you know, we could go on for an hour, but we're out of time.
Oh,
it's been
okay.
Such a great pleasure. Can I really call you and get you onto some of our other programs? Maybe we could do a program some evening where we could take the full 2 hours, if you wouldn't mind.
This is fun. I really enjoy it, and you know I'm always happy to help out. May I give my website?
You please do.
Okay. It's very simple, ellentrailer.com. That's ellentrailor, all one word, .com.
And Ellen's books are wonderful. And so anyway, ellentrailer.com. God bless you. We'll be talking to you later.
Thank you very much.
Good night.
Good night.
All right, that was Ellen Gundersen Trailer, and certainly one of my favorite authors. I hope she'll become one of yours. If you'd like to know more about her books, I think we carry all of them. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We were talking primarily tonight about the priest and the oracle. And if you enjoyed, you know, the Da Vinci Code, you'll love these books. These are fast-moving adventure novels that are never going to get the play that the others will. Why? Because they're Christian novels. They're written from a Christian perspective. And, of course, they will certainly bring you into a closer personal relationship with our Lord Jesus Christ. So let me recommend the books to you. Fascinating. All of her Ellen books are wonderful. In fact, we really should get Ellen on a more regular basis. Certainly one of my favorite guests, and I hope yours as well. Well, this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we really depend on those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every weekday, and then we do our weekend programs as well. And we spend our time full-time trying to educate the American people about this spiritual battle in which we're engaged. And if you'd like to help us join the Radio Liberty family, our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. And if you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters, give us a call. Our February newsletter will give you some real insight into the war on terrorism. At least, well, that's what they call it, a war on terrorism. But is it really a war on terrorism, or is there another agenda? Our telephone number again, 1-800-544-8927. Our website, radioliberty.com. And, of course, then, until, please pray for America, pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Till we're together again, may the Lord be with you. Stand By for Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we invite your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please don't call unless we ask for the calls, because, well, we're going to have a fascinating program. We have this Dr. John Cannell from the Vitamin D Council, and you probably have never heard of the Vitamin D Council out there in the listening audience, and I'll have to admit that I'd never heard of the Vitamin D Council until my good friend Bill Sardi put me in touch with Dr. Cannell. Basically, when I went to medical school, and I think when those doctors went to medical school, we learned about the various vitamins, A, B, and there were three B vitamins, and then there were another couple of B vitamins, 5, 6, 12, C and D and E, and but we were always told, you know, if you eat a well-balanced diet, you're going to get plenty of this, you got nothing to worry about, and, you know, if you take multivitamin, well, let people take a multivitamin, but, you know, it's not going to do much of any good anyway, just eat a well-balanced diet, and that's all there is to it. Well, Dr. Cannell, of course, and the people he works with in the Vitamin D Council have an entirely different attitude towards vitamin D. And I think that you'll be fascinated by what he has to say. Dr. Cannell, thank you so very much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Why don't you just go ahead and you pick up the story?
Well, you know, the story of vitamin D is one that's just unfolding as we talk. For example, yesterday, there were two papers published, one that showed that there was a good, sound theoretical reason to think vitamin D should help treat tuberculosis, and then the second paper published a couple of hours later showed that patients who have tuberculosis who were 10,000 units of vitamin D a day was added to their regimen, they had a 100% cure rate. Now, I say this because it all happened within the last 24 hours, and because it's a disease that no one even thinks is in any way could be related to vitamin D, and yet that the field is unfolding that quickly. And it's almost a new story every day, from cancer to heart disease to stroke to dementia to depression. It appears likely that vitamin D plays a role in all those illnesses.
No, of course, the idea that the vitamin D would help in fighting tuberculosis is something that would be quite foreign to most doctors. You know, but of course, tuberculosis, it was certainly a plague when I was in medical school, and then it disappeared, and we saw very little tuberculosis for many years, and now in more recent years it's been coming back, and not only that, but a multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis, which certainly can be fatal. And so the fact that there is something that can actually help that is really, really rather exciting, isn't it?
It is. And this was a double-blind, placebo-controlled study that showed that it helped. And it also gives you a clue. If one wants to look for diseases that might be helped by vitamin D, one you need to look to history or look to epidemiology. And whenever you find a disease that is more common in the winter, that's more common at higher latitudes, or that was effectively treated in the early part of the century when sunshine was where every good doctor in the country recommended sunshine.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan of the Vitamin. Our guest today is Dr. John Cannell of the Vitamin D Council, and he's simply pointing out that there are certain diseases that are much more prevalent in the wintertime. And of course, we might even mention one of these would be influenza. Wait, there's an influenza season. We don't see influenza usually in the summer. We see it in the winter. What's the relationship between influenza and sunlight and vitamin D?
Well, that stage unfolding. I mean, people have known for a long time that respiratory diseases, upper and lower respiratory diseases, many of the viral ones were virtually unheard of in the summertime and were common in the winter. In fact, the common cold got its name because it came on with the cold weather. And now just recently, there is evidence that vitamin D is involved in the production of what are called antimicrobial proteins. Those are your body's antibiotics. And they are so much better than any antibiotic a doctor can prescribe. They do not get resistant to bacteria. They are produced in right in the tissues where they're needed, and they're extremely active. There's more than 200 of these natural antibiotics that have been described. But people have been desperately almost looking for what is it that upregulates them, what increases their expression in the human body. And so far as I know, the only thing that's been found to clearly do that is the activated form of vitamin D. Again, this research came within the last year.
And so this is really all sort of new, and of course the thing is, what's the relationship for our listeners out there who may not be acquainted with really where vitamin D comes from? What's the relationship between sunlight and vitamin D?
Well, sunlight makes an incredible amount of vitamin D. In fact, when I tell you that this, I'm going to tell you the fact that changed my life. 3 years ago, I was reading about various subjects, and I stumbled upon vitamin D, and I read the following fact. And the fact is this, is that when you go out into the sunshine, in your bathing suit, in the summertime, that you make up to 50,000 units of vitamin D within an hour. Now that's about 250 times more vitamin D than exists in a glass of milk. Now, when I stumbled across that fact, I thought about it, and I read more, because the question came to me, why? Why would humans have developed a system that makes that much vitamin D so very quickly? And now, after studying about it, the answer is nobody knows, but God probably did it for a good reason.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Dr. John Cannell, and we're talking about vitamin D. And, of course, well, what most people may or may not even think of is that every time you go out in the sunlight, why the sun actually hitting your skin, there's a substance there. I think it's called gesterol. You correct me on that. But there's a substance in the skin that when the sun hits it, it converts it into vitamin D. So you can actually produce your own vitamin D simply by in the sunlight. The trouble is that those of us who are inside most of the time, we don't get out in the sunlight, we need vitamin D supplements. If we develop the deficiency with all of the complications, would that be a proper statement?
Yes, it is a proper statement. The more you follow most doctors' advice, the more vitamin D deficient you become.
Now, what is that substance in the skin that is converted into vitamin D?
7-dehydrocholesterol, or called precholecalciferol.
All right, fine.
Yeah. And one of the problems is that virtually every doctor you meet advises people that, not to go out in the sun. Sunlight has been as bad a thing currently as it was a good thing in the 1920s and 1930s. And one of the effects of that is probably for the first time in human history, we have now true cavemen. We have people who get up in their house in the morning, put on some sunblock just in case, get in their car in their covered garage, drive to work, and glass blocks out all UVB radiation. Then they park in a covered garage at their workplace, they work, and then they go home, and they reverse the process and go home. Now, cavemen never did that. They might have lived in a cave, but they were out in the sun a lot. So we have now people who go out of their way to never let a ray of sunlight strike their skin. And it's a huge naturalistic experiment.
And of course, vitamin D is essential for so many functions in the human body. So I'm going to let you maybe perhaps tell our listeners where vitamin D is important. As an orthopedic surgeon, we knew that it played an important part as far as calcium metabolism, but that's simply just one small part of its function, isn't it?
Yeah, it's useful to think of vitamin D as a series of pools along a mountain stream. The very top pool, the most important pool, is to maintain your calcium economy, and that prevents your serum, your blood calcium, from getting too low. If you only have a little vitamin D in your body, it will all go to doing that, because that maintains your calcium, and if your calcium falls, you die. So that's its most important immediate function. But if you get enough vitamin D, there's a series of pools beneath this maintaining the blood calcium pool. And those are the pools that are now being explored very rapidly, and it's very exciting. But below that, maintaining the calcium economy pool is a pool of preventing heart disease, of preventing and perhaps even being useful in helping treat cancer, in preventing and perhaps even treating some forms of dementia, to preventing multiple sclerosis, to preventing some forms of diabetes, to effectively treating some forms of hypertension. Depression, major depression has been shown to have a vitamin D deficient component. Many of these diseases in the future, it will be like hypertension. One cause of hypertension is vitamin D deficiency. Vitamin D will not effectively treat all cases of hypertension, but within the population of hypertensive, there's certainly going to be a subset of people who simply have vitamin D deficiency and their hypertension disappears with adequate treatment. But beneath the top pool along this mountain stream are what looks like perhaps hundreds of pools of different functions of the vitamin D that only can occur if there's enough vitamin D flowing into the system to get past that top pool.
All right, fine. So it has a profound impact on so many aspects of our life, and this is something that most people don't think of, and even most doctors don't think of, this idea that we really don't want to get out in the sunlight because we might get skin cancer, and yet, of course, is this really true? What's the relationship between sunlight and, regular skin cancer and then melanomas?
Sunlight increases your risk for non-melanoma skin cancer. That's squamous cell and basal cell cancer. And about 1,500 people a year die from those cancers. Those cancers are generally a nuisance if you see a dermatologist on a regular basis. Occasionally one will slip by, but generally the people who die from those cancers are people who ignore growths on their skin for many, many years. So those cancers are clearly associated with the sunlight. Many dermatologists are convinced and try to scare patients into believing that melanoma, another form of skin cancer which kills about 8,000 Americans a year, try to convince us that that's in fact caused by sunlight. And in fact, the two biggest, best, and most recent studies in fact show probably the opposite is true. That in some ways that sunlight is protective against both the development and the progression of melanoma. That one thing that sunlight does is age your skin, and that's a fact. Anybody can tell that from looking at people who spend a lot of time in the sun. And I think in some ways that's a very important fact, because oftentimes people will say, I don't really care that much about cancer or heart disease, but if it's going to make me look older, I don't want any part of it. So I think a lot of people stay inside and stay out of the sun because they don't want the sun to age their skin. And that's why supplements are so important.
All right, fine. Well, somebody just called in, wanted to know if milk was a good source of vitamin D. Is it, do we really need supplements on top of that?
Yes. If you drink about 40 glasses of milk a day, you'll get enough vitamin D.
And not very many people are going to do that, of course. And, yes. and besides that, a lot of milk is certainly not good for males because yes. we know it increases the incidence of prostate and other cancers. And you really need to, because that's a subject for an entirely different program. So certainly we need the supplements. Now, in what form would we get the supplements and how much should the average individual be taking?
Yeah, obviously I didn't mean for anybody to drink 40 glasses of milk a day, but some people just assume that if they drink a glass or two of milk a day, they get enough vitamin D, and they do not. They get basically a homeopathic amount if they drink a couple glasses of milk a day. So you can't get it from milk. You can get it from your diet if you eat a lot of fatty fish, mackerel, salmon, and sardines. But other than that, unless you're willing to have mackerel for breakfast, or sardines for lunch, and salmon for dinner all the time, you really can't get it because vitamin D was never made to be put in your mouth. It was made to be made. It was designed to be made in your skin. And so, if you're going to go out of the sun, if you're going to stay indoors and not let the sunlight strike you, you have to take vitamin D supplements. How much you need to take depends a lot upon the latitude you live at, depends upon your body weight. It depends upon your race, and it depends upon your age. Because even though you avoid the sun, virtually everybody gets some vitamin D from incidental sunlight. It's reflected up off the ground, et cetera. So there's a lot of controversy about how much is needed. But the government says that 2,000 units a day is safe for anybody to take without being under a doctor's care. And that's a good start for many people, and that certainly won't make anybody sick or toxic. And it's not enough for many people, but it's a lot more than most people are taking. So I generally recommend people take 2,000 units a day unless they understand what they're doing and unless they've learned something about the physiology of vitamin D, and particularly if they get their blood levels checked periodically. There's a blood test called a 25-hydroxyvitamin D level, which I predict will probably be the most single most important blood test in preventative medicine in the future.
Well, of course, when I went to medical school, one of the things they taught us about was vitamin D toxicity. And, of course, we were told there's certain people who take massive amounts of vitamin C, and then they begin to get, I've forgotten whether it was hypercalcemia. That was one of the causes of hypercalcemia, because vitamin D does act on the bone. But I remember, of course, that many times treating osteoporosis, we used to use 50,000 units of vitamin D twice a day, maybe twice a week, and nobody ever seemed to get into trouble with that. In fact, you could take probably 50,000 units a day for several months without getting into trouble, although you probably wouldn't want to take that indefinitely. Would that be a fairly accurate appraisal or not?
That is very accurate. The upper limit of toxicity is probably somewhere above 10,000 units a day for years and years and years on end.
Well, now, there's 10,000. Do we really need up to 10,000 a day?
Nobody knows the answer to that question. When you get up to doses like 10,000 or 50,000 units, we're talking about the use of vitamin D as a drug. And that's quite different from the use of vitamin D to prevent certain illnesses or to make sure that you have an adequate immune system. But for example, the dose used with the tuberculosis patients that was reported yesterday, that's using vitamin D as a drug. And I predict it will be a very effective drug in a wide variety of situations. But you probably know the story about the drug. If it can't be patented, not many people are interested in. And vitamin D is a cost next to nothing. Nobody's going to make any money selling vitamin D. Nobody knows how much you need. But, uses of 10,000, 20,000, 50,000 units a day will be what we call pharmacological uses, and without a doubt, there'll be many more diseases other than tuberculosis that will be shown to have beneficial effects from vitamin D.
All right, well, our guest is Dr. John Cannell from the Vitamin D Council, and we're talking about the beneficial effects of vitamin D. It's sort of something that most people don't really think about too much, and yet, of course, it's something that we should have a lot more of. And where we're living in a normal life where we're out in the sunlight every day, well, I would be getting, of course, a good dose of it. However, in the wintertime, even if you're out in the sun, why, because the sun's low on the horizon, you don't get the full impact. Well, we're going to be back in just a couple of minutes, and we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Dr. John Cannell. Now, what about what part does vitamin D play in calcium metabolism? You talked about the pools along the stream, and the first one was certainly calcium. What's the relationship between vitamin D and calcium metabolism?
Well, the vitamin D has two main functions in the body. One is called the endocrine function of vitamin D. And the second one is called the autocrine, or perhaps paracrine, function of vitamin D. Endocrine just means that some organ in the body makes a hormone that is circulated by the blood. And so when you go out in the sun, or when you take vitamin D supplements, they are absorbed in your intestine or absorbed in your skin, and then they're eventually converted in the kidney to a hormone called calcitriol, or activated vitamin D. Activated vitamin D is one of the most potent steroid hormones in the human body. And it acts to regulate calcium by increasing calcium absorption, decreasing calcium excretion from the kidney and the intestine, and other things that help maintain the calcium economy. But a lot of people don't understand or think of vitamin D as a steroid hormone, but it is, in fact, it's as much of a steroid hormone as testosterone or estrogen or progesterone or any steroid hormone. Steroid hormones are simply any substance that has a sterol base and that acts to turn your genes on and off. And that's exactly what vitamin D does. It works by turning genes on and off. That's a profound mechanism of action.
Well, now, would it have the same effect as the androgen or estrogenic hormones? Would it affect any of our muscle function or our athletic function?
Well, that's a great question, since it's not a sex steroid, it doesn't have the masculizing or feminizing effects of the sex steroid. But there is a compelling amount of literature that shows that it improves muscle function. Now, that data is mostly in older people, but I'm personally convinced that there are a number of young people in this country who are vitamin D deficient, whose athletic function would improve significantly if they took the right amount of vitamin D. And I stress the right amount because the studies also indicate if you take too much, that sort of impairs muscle function. So yes, there's evidence that it would improve athletic function. There's evidence that it improves people's musculoskeletal abilities in lots of ways, from muscle strength to coordination to reaction time and balance. Decreases the number of falls in older people. And if you talk to anyone who's been up on this for a while and has maintained their vitamin D levels in the optimum range for a couple of years, they'll all tell you the same thing. They'll tell you that they are quicker, and that they seem to sort of be on the peak of their game all the time. In fact, in the coming newsletter, I'm going to talk about the possibilities of athletic improvement with vitamin D. But the fact is, the steroid hormone is very, very important, because that makes it's unlike any other vitamin. And the fact that it works by turning your genes on and off tells you that it has a possible mechanism of action in any disease you can possibly think of.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here with Dr. Cannell. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Dr. John Cannell. We're talking about vitamin D. And, of course, vitamin D apparently acts in the body by turning genes on and off. Now, genes are what make the amino acids, and the amino acids make our proteins. And so, if you can control these genes, of course, you can get them to do what they want to, while you can really alter function. And there's certain master proteins, substances, or even in this case, a steroid hormone that will actually impact on the function of those genes. This probably will be the wave of the future, don't you think, really, as far as medicine is concerned?
Yes, I do. And it's important to understand that what we're talking about is not taking extra steroid hormones so that you get an exaggeration of what the of what the hormone does, like when people take extra testosterone or other kind of anabolic steroids. It doesn't work that way. You're either at an ideal level or you're not. And if you take too little or if you take too much, you will not have what is normal function in many ways. And the best way to know what normal function is simply look at what normal levels should be. Is simply look at what the species, what level has the human species had for the 2 million years it's been on Earth. And you can know that by simply drawing the blood levels of people who live and work in the sun. And when you do that, you find that people who live and work in the sun, such as lifeguards or people who live around the equator, they have blood levels that are about 3 times higher than the average modern American.
Well, then, are they healthier than the average normal American?
Well, if you screen out, you know, if you go down to the equator and you screen out the diseases that kill people quite frequently, childhood diseases and stuff, then you look and see what the incidence of multiple sclerosis is, or the incidence of heart disease, and the incidence of hypertension, the incidence of a number of different diseases. And anytime you find a latitudinal variation, if a disease if the incidence increases the further away from the equator you go, you have a clue that there is a significant contribution of vitamin D. But your direct question, you know, the people who live around the equator live longer, that they do not. And it's because there's so many other factors that affect it, poverty and the number of infectious diseases that apparently have no relation at all to vitamin D. And I'm sure there's many infectious diseases that vitamin D will not help you at all with.
Well, of course, you've mentioned, certainly the possibility of tuberculosis. Do we know of its impact on any other type of infectious disease?
We don't, and of course, there's this one study about tuberculosis, one controlled study, so that obviously has to be confirmed and repeated. But it appears likely that vitamin D, in terms of infectious disease, is going to be effective wherever there is an inadequate amount of natural antibiotics, and that's mainly in the lung and to some extent in the intestine. So I imagine the main impact of vitamin D in infectious disease is going to be in respiratory diseases.
Well, of course, we hear, of course, this idea of colds. Colds come in the wintertime, flu comes in the wintertime. And, of course, most people, when they have their cold, they say, oh, I'm going to take a lot of vitamin C. Should they be taking vitamin C and vitamin D, do you think, or do we have any studies to that effect?
You know, there aren't any studies I'm aware of that looked at that. And one of the problems, of course, with vitamin C is for it to be an effective antimicrobial agent, you have to maintain very high blood levels for a period of time, and they're hard to obtain with oral doses of vitamin C. What we're talking about with vitamin D is a question if you took enough vitamin D to maintain your blood levels in the winter, like they are in the summer, what would happen? And if you talk to anybody who has discovered this and who has started to take adequate amounts of vitamin D, they'll tell you the same thing. They just don't get colds and flu. And when they do, it's such a malocase, you're not even sure that you're sick. You kind of can feel a little bit of discomfort, a little bit of scratchy throat, a little bit of nose, etc. But you just don't get toxic like some people do with influenza. Even with a common cold.
So, of course, there are no controlled studies on this, but it's really empirical, and the people who take fairly amounts of vitamin D, during the fall and winter, that certainly is something to do, start thinking about, because, you know, sometimes people are laid up for a week or 2 weeks or even longer after influenza.
Yes. Actually, there are some studies. There's several studies using UVB light or sunlight and comparing the incidence of respiratory infection in both adults and children. All of them show that children who are exposed regularly to ultraviolet light, whether it be artificial or sunlight, have a reduced incidence of the symptoms of respiratory infection.
Hold that thought right there, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dr. John Cannell of the Vitamin D Council, and of course we're talking about, of all things, vitamin D, but this is something that, you know, most people don't think about, and yet there's so much evidence that it really is essential, and that specifically in the wintertime, we're not getting adequate supplies of this. And you were saying that there really have been, then, these studies that show that ultraviolet light on children does decrease significantly their incidence of colds and other respiratory diseases during the winter months?
Yes, there are. There were a number of studies about this in the 20s and 30s. Some of the studies conflicted, and then there have been some more studies, two in the United States, one in 1945 and one in the 80s, and then there have been a series of studies in the Russian literature where they would especially irradiate children with or workers with ultraviolet radiation of the wavelength that creates vitamin D, and they would just check to see what the absenteeism rate was and what the reported symptomatology was, and all of the studies that I've been able to find so far all show an effect. There was also one very interesting small study that was reported in 1992 where a doctor somewhere in the tropics simply noticed that there were lots of children with subclinical rickets who were getting one infection after another, one respiratory infection, a cold or whatever. And he took a group of them and gave them 60,000 units of vitamin D a week for 6 weeks. And luckily, you're an experienced physician, so you know that's not very much, but to a lot of people that sounds like it's a huge amount, and it's really not. But what he noticed and what he reported, it was in that group of children who took the vitamin D, their frequent respiratory infections totally disappeared for the next 6 months.
Here's for our guests out there why rickets is a disease of children who are not getting adequate vitamin D for one reason or another, and of course then they begin to get bones and really suffer abnormal development. And of course, I don't think I ever saw a case of rickets here in the United States. I probably saw a few of them when I practiced in Africa, but it's a relatively rare disease because most of our children get vitamins, you know, mothers get vitamins, children get vitamins. Do you think that this is really warded off most rickets here in the United States?
Yes, rickets is up close to the top of the mountain pool. You don't need a whole lot of vitamin D to prevent rickets, or the adult form of rickets, which is called osteomalacia. But those diseases are intimately involved with maintaining the calcium economy.
So hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were simply talking about rickets. Children used to get rickets, and in certain parts of the world they do, especially if they have black skin, and they cannot absorb the vitamin D sunlight normally. But here in the United States, rickets is not a factor. It was many, many years ago in areas, but now ordinarily most children will get a vitamin of some sort, a multivitamin, that'll have enough vitamin D in it so that they're not getting rickets. But then we were talking about the osteomalacia, which means osteo bone, malacia softening. And osteomalacia is a disease we see of older people where they have softened bones. Now, will adequate doses of vitamin C tend to decrease the incidence of osteomalacia?
Vitamin D, if the osteomalacia is secondary to vitamin D deficiency, then vitamin D will cure the condition. It can also be secondary to inadequate calcium intake, but that's rarer. Osteomalacia actually often presents as painful bones. A number of people who have been diagnosed with chronic pain syndrome, fibromyalgia and others, can have osteomalacia, and you can make that diagnosis clinically by seeing if they have significant increased pain with pressure on their bones, either in their sternum or their tibia and fibula. Treatment for that particular condition is very rewarding. There's also, just again, to get an idea of the spectrum of diseases that we're talking about, we started talking about tuberculosis, and we haven't really spent much time talking about cancer, but chronic pain, there have been several studies now that indicate that a significant amount of people with just chronic pain, chronic low back pain, what we call idiopathic pain, where the doctor just can't find out why it hurts so much, that a number of those people will respond to adequate amounts of vitamin D. Sometimes when I talk like this, I know people must be scratching their head and thinking, this is just not possible. You know, all these different diseases, I've heard this before with vitamin E, or with vitamin C, I've just heard it before. And it's one of the most difficult things to get across is the incredible amount of research that's being done on this as we talk. No, nobody really knows what the extent of this hormone and the deficiency of this hormone, and what the extent of it is, and what the ramifications are. But the story is quickly unfolding in the scientific literature.
All right. Well, let's go to a caller, and we'll just put our number out. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY.
Advanced, you know, this despondency and the depression that they get from the lack of the sunlight. Would they benefit from the use of vitamin D as much as they would, say, from the sunlight?
Well, nobody knows for sure. There's one study that directly looked at that issue. They took a number of people with seasonal affective disorder, which is what you're speaking of, and
right.
They gave half of them, seen a number of people, especially with mood disorders, who after they've been on vitamin D for either several months, or sometimes it takes even longer, a year or so, the mood disorders are much, much improved. This is a even though it's a potent steroid hormone, in many ways its effects are rather subtle. And you have to have adequate vitamin D nutrition for a while, and you almost always see an improvement in your mood. You'll see an improvement in your fingernails; those lines, those ridges, will go away. Your dentist will congratulate you because you're flossing twice a day, finally, like he wants you to, and you don't have the nerve to tell him you're not flossing at all. But gingivitis virtually disappears with people with adequate vitamin D nutrition. These things take time, but they're dramatic, it's by far the most rewarding supplemental approach I think you can take to your health.
Anything else, Barbara?
No, so you're suggesting that long-term supplementation, you know, is far better than a huge dose.
Yes, huge doses should be avoided, except
right.
when the drug is used by a physician for as a drug. Huge doses are not physiological. It's best to get your vitamin D like your ancestors got it, and that's by getting the right amount every day. And you have to learn about the physiology of vitamin D. You have to have some idea of how much you're going to make in a day if you're in your normal activities. So if it's in a winter time, for example, and you're at a latitude where there's no ultraviolet B radiation in the atmosphere, you know you're going to have to take more than if you're outside in the summer and you're at the beach or you're playing tennis or you play golf. And then, of course, in those days, you wouldn't have to take any at all. So it takes some sophistication to understand this nutrient and to use it the correct way.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, fine. Well, that was Barbara calling from Santa Cruz. And if you're out there and you have a question for us, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Now, one of the things, of course, we used to be besieged with as orthopedic surgeons was the entity of osteoporosis, which is it's simply postmenopausal osteoporosis in women seems to be related, of course, to a lack of sex hormones, and of course, cause softening of the bone, very much like osteomalacia. Certainly, histologically, it was somewhat different, but one was related to vitamin C. But does vitamin D, have any relationship to the treatment of or any part in the treatment of postmenopausal osteoporosis?
Yes, it does, but I think its effects there are probably less dramatic than about any other disease I've mentioned. And the reason for that is because osteoporosis can occur for a wide variety of reasons. As you mentioned, just the withdrawal of the sex hormones, whether it be estrogen or testosterone, can induce vitamin D, can induce osteoporosis. But, you know, it requires an adequate calcium intake, it requires an adequate magnesium intake, it requires adequate amounts of vitamin D to prevent it. It requires vitamin K to prevent it. And perhaps more important than any of those is that modern human diets result in a mildly metabolic acidosis in the body. And that acidosis, if you know, if any cook can tell you how to get the calcium out of a bone, that's to put it in the pot and put a little vinegar in, and that'll leach out, that acetic acid in the vinegar will leach out the calcium. Well, modern humans, because our diet is so poor in vegetables in particular, and because we're so high in processed food, we have a chronic metabolic acidosis that our ancestors never had. So many of us sort of live in mildly acid pools that leach the calcium out of our bones. So there's so many things. A lot of people think, well, if I take adequate vitamin D, I won't get osteoporosis, or my osteoposis will go away. And vitamin D is one of many factors that are needed to be addressed in the treatment and prevention of osteoporosis.
But you're saying that an alkaline state of the body would be better than the acid state of the body.
Yes, the body is naturally adapted to a mildly alkaline state.
All right, because certainly then, are you suggesting that maybe up to 2,000 international units of vitamin D a day would be a good dose for the average individual? I mean, I think that, what is it, about 400 units that the government advocates?
Well, you know, the government advises people under 50 to take 200 units, or people between 50 and 70 to take 400 units, and people over the age of 70 to take 600 units. And that's only for the prevention of osteoporosis. When those recommendations came out in 1998, it's clear that they were only saying this is what the science shows that may be helpful in preventing osteoporosis, this dose of vitamin D. Not to say that was the only thing that would prevent osteoporosis, but that was proven to be one thing that was a factor. They didn't address any of these other diseases because they just didn't have adequate amounts of data to consider them. And since that meeting and the Food and Nutrition Board met to formulate the current recommendations, there's been an explosion of literature about this substance. And most people think it's time that the Institute of Medicine and the Food and Nutrition Board look into this subject again and revise their estimates.
Well,
but to answer your question, 2,000 units, you're within the government guidelines for safety. They say up to 2,000 units a day is safe for anybody to take. So if you take 2,000 units a day, that's certainly probably better than what you're taking.
And you think then that there would be an element of certainly a benefit from taking an adequate dose?
Yes, that will not be an adequate dose for some people. It depends upon, it won't be an adequate dose for many African Americans. It will not be an adequate dose for many older people because they have both impaired absorption from their intestine and because they cannot make vitamin D from their skin as well. But 2,000 units a day would be a gigantic leap forward for just about anybody's health.
Well, of course, as a physician, I've noticed that blacks seem to age more readily than whites do, and certainly we know that they die much at a younger age, by a fair amount, to the point where most of blacks don't collect their Social Security, whereas most whites do. Do you think that vitamin D, a large dose of vitamin D, a couple of thousand units of vitamin D for blacks would really help them? Is there any evidence it might prolong their age?
That's a very interesting question, because if you look at the diseases that differentially kill African Americans compared to whites, the list of diseases is almost identical to the list of diseases that is now being associated with vitamin D deficiency. And I think it is probable that the main reason there's this huge inequity between the life expectancy of whites and African Americans is because if you're African American, the chances of you being vitamin D deficient are virtually 100%.
Well, I think that's really very interesting, and I do hope that our African American listeners will pay attention to this. I think this is a very important factor, and certainly it would only be logical that this would certainly be playing a part in that, because of course the black like the white, and most of them are not out in the sunlight, and if they are out in the sunlight, they're still not going to be getting the amount that they need. Certainly, if they were living in the equatorial area, it would be entirely different than living here in the northern, more temperate climates.
Yeah, one of the ways you know how important vitamin D is because humans who do live in equatorial climates develop a very black skin. They can make all the vitamin D they need through that skin if they're out in the sun. But when about 50,000 years ago, when some humans started to migrate to the extremes of the equator, to the extremes of latitude, it was remarkable how quickly skin lightened. I mean, from an evolutionary point of view, that change occurs very, very quickly, and it has to, because if you have very dark skin and you're living at 60 or 70 degrees latitude, you're going to be very vitamin D deficient. So that those changes occur rapidly.
Well, now, of course, you mentioned that as a psychiatrist, you actually check the vitamin D levels in your patients. Do you notice that, I don't know the makeup of your practice, but do you notice that blacks have a tendency towards a lower vitamin D level than the whites?
Oh, yeah. On the average, their levels are about half of whites. And there are large studies that show that. Average, it depends on how the test is done and the methodology used to measure 25-hydroxyvitamin D levels, but anytime there's a comparison, African-Americans have average levels of about 50% what white levels are.
Well, I think that's really fascinating. What about the element of sphincter control? Does an inadequacy of vitamin D play any a part in that?
I'd be surprised if it didn't, but I know of no studies that indicated that it does, because vitamin D is so involved in muscle function.
How is it? Is it involved with muscle function because of its relationship to calcium, or does it have a direct effect on the muscle itself, the steroid effect?
Right. There are vitamin D receptors in muscle that actually, very interestingly, actually respond as much to 25-hydroxyvitamin D as it does to the activated form of vitamin D called calcitriol, or 1,25-dihydroxyvitamin D. So muscle has a sort of a unique role in vitamin D functioning. And when you certainly anyone who pays attention to this and starts to maintain and to obtain first and then maintain adequate vitamin D health, they'll notice an improvement in muscle function, but I know of no studies in terms of sphincters.
Well, guys, you know, one of the interesting things, we watch the Olympics, the Winter Olympics or the Summer Olympics, and you have superb athletes. I mean, you have, amazing, abilities. And yet, of course, I was watching some skating the other night. There were 0.04 of a second difference between the winner and the loser, or the second person who came in second. Do you think that the vitamin D would in any way enhance muscle function? Because you only need a little bit of edge, of course, to be the winner. And, of course, there's certainly laws against taking any sort of androgenic or pre-androgenic hormones. But what about vitamin D? Would that play a part?
Well, I mean, I don't see how they could regulate it, because you could just go out in the sunshine or go into a suntan booth and you could get it. But the answer is absolutely. I think that there are a number of German and Russian studies. When I researched this for writing a paper, I went and looked at the literature and found there was in the late 40s and in the 50s in the German and Russian literature, there was an enormous attention paid to ultraviolet light and athletic performance. And there were a number of studies demonstrating that it improved the time on the 100-meter dash, and we're talking taking 5 to 8% off of a fairly well-trained athlete's time, reaction time, powerlifting, muscle strength, et cetera, training ability. And I'm convinced that you and I sound about the same age, and I'm sure you remember in the 60s and 70s and 80s, what countries came in 1 and 2 year after year in the Olympics?
Of course, the Russians did.
East Germans and the Russians.
Right.
And why? You know, they don't anymore. But I'm convinced that one of the reasons they did that is because their scientists knew about the effects of ultraviolet light, if not the effects of vitamin D, and I believe those athletes were in peak vitamin D nutrition when they competed, although I have no way of proving that.
All right, we're going to be back here just to wrap up our program here in just a moment here with Dr. John Cannell of the Vitamin D Council. Well, Dr. Cannell, how can people get in touch with your organization and keep abreast of these fast-breaking things, events that are happening?
Well, just Google the Vitamin D Council and you come to our website and you can sign up for our newsletter there.
And is this an email letter or what?
Yeah, I send out an email letter, yes, an email newsletter.
And how often does it come out?
When I can get around to writing it.
You're sort of like I am. Of course, I'm in a position I have to write a newsletter every month, and I will tell you that really gets to be a drag, but, you know, it also requires a certain amount of self-discipline. So.
Yes, it does. I try to put one out at the beginning of every month, and it's a free newsletter, so people understand that it's a little bit late. Sometimes it gets a little too long because I address a certain issue that an academic, certain faction of the vitamin D academic community is interested in. Other times it's more general issues. The most popular newsletters I have are the ones where there are questions and answers, and I'll try to do more of those.
And do you think there's an increasing awareness of the part that vitamin D plays, in our physiology, on the part of physicians across America? Or are you trying to increase that awareness?
Yeah, I wish. I mean, I wish that were true. I don't know if you know the history of beriberi, for example, or some of the other nutritional diseases. Modern medicine fought for years and years and years and decades against the idea that inadequate nutrition could cause any disease. And the claims that are being made about vitamin D now, I know are going to turn off many physicians. They're going to just say, this is simply not possible, and they're going to dig their heels in. I wish that I could be hopeful about modern medicine looking at the recent literature and evaluating it objectively.
Well, I think the exciting thing, though, is if you have the scientific backing, why are you going to begin to get people at least thinking along these lines? And this is really so vitally important. And certainly, there's so much research going on today that validate these points. It's just a matter of being able to get them into the hands of our physicians and the people working in the medical field.
That's true.
All right, well, we've just got about 40 seconds before I let you go. Is there any parting thought that you would have for our listeners tonight?
The safest thing to do is to get safe sun exposure in the late spring, the summer, and the early fall, and then to take 2,000 units of vitamin D a day, or maybe even a little bit more during the wintertime. That's the safest advice I can give you.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. I know it's getting a little late down there, but anyway, thank you so very much, and I hope maybe we can get you back on our other programs. You can keep us abreast of the rapidly changing field.
I enjoyed it.
Good night. God bless.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we try to get on the health issues, and certainly Dr. John Cannell is one of the leading experts on this field. He works in here in the state of California, somewhat south of where we are. We actually have, of course, I think some excellent material on health and health issues. Certainly among them would be our good friend Dr. Russell Blaylock's book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. I know my wife uses that almost as a Bible because it's got so much information in there, and there's so many harmful things that they put in food, and they conceal what they are by changing the name. So Dr. Blaylock has done a great job of telling you all the various names that they'll give you, the MSG and soy products. And then, of course, he's written the book Excitotoxins, The Taste That Kills, and his latest book, Natural Strategies for Health Patients. So that's Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. Excitotoxins, The Taste That Kills, which really goes into the background of the NutraSweet, which, of course, was a deadly poison. They put it in our food. And you say, oh, I don't believe that could happen. Well, you really need to read the scientific studies, and certainly Dr. Blaylock lists them there. We actually have a great deal of information up on the Internet, and certainly Betty Martini's website. We'll give you doorway, doorway.com. We'll give you the source of all of the scientific studies that produces pathological obesity, the impacts on fertility, and certainly it produces cancer. They know all of these things because there are people in government who have a different agenda. And we can thank Donald Rumsfeld for getting us in over the objection of all of the health scientists back in 1981, and they've been poisoning the American people for 25 years. And one of the things that these produce, and of course these would be things like aspartame, Nutrasweet, and of course MSG products, they produce pathological obesity. Oh my goodness, look at all those fat people. It's because, you know, they're just eating too many hamburgers, or it's the Colonel's fault, or no, of course, a lot, much of this is aspartame, they know that. They put out all this propaganda just to confuse you, and they confuse you intentionally. So we recommend, of course, Health and Nutrition Secrets Can Save Your Life. Excitotoxins, the taste it kills. Health and Nutrition Secrets, I should say Natural Strategies for Health Patients. And if you know somebody who's going to be going in for chemotherapy, I know we had a woman called us the other day. She was so grateful because her daughter or her daughter-in-law had actually going in for chemotherapy, used these basic strategies, and her hair didn't fall out. She didn't get sick. The doctor couldn't believe it, wanted to know what she was doing. And of course, the patient didn't tell him that she had read Dr. Blaylock's book. We have a 4-tape set with Dr. Blaylock. We have 4-tape sets on the statin drugs that are poisoning the American people, on magnesium. We have an excellent book on death by medicine, death by RX by Dr. Strand. So much information there. If you'd like to know more, why give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and then we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family and help us as we've reached out 5 hours every day. And then pray for America, pray for revival, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty. Again, our number, 1-800-544-8927, 544-8927.